Welcome to Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz, a candid conversation as we learn about types of dementias, such as Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, frontal temporal, and Lewy body, and the effects on the people we love. Jill's years of dedication and experience help you adapt, overcome obstacles, and find positive outcomes. It's time for Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz.
Well, hey, friends. We've sure had a lot going on around the world right now with the coronavirus and how it's affecting all countries and people of all ages. And I know it is particularly disturbing to those of you who are now isolated in your homes for weeks on end and maybe can't go into the care communities to visit your loved ones. And I know this is really a tough situation. I want to offer you some ideas about embracing what we can still do and what is not canceled versus what you can no longer do. So some of those ideas could be maybe doing some video taping on your phones and sending it to your loved one in the community. You could ask the person who is the community relations person. They're usually the person that you first met when you came into a community to put your loved one there, and see if you could send it to their phone or to the general manager's phone and have them show it to your loved one. You can have kids write messages on posters and have them take them in. Maybe if you laminate them, they wouldn't have the virus sitting on them. If you don't have the virus, you don't have to worry about it anyway. Just simple phone calls and things like that will help enormously when your loved one is upset or angry and maybe wondering why you're not coming to visit. So think about those kinds of things, ways that you can communicate. Have a puzzle, 25-piece puzzle shipped over, maybe from Amazon or something like that. And see if a restaurant that has been closed and can only do takeout or have pickup, send lunch for the staff. Do something like that, which could help enormously when we're in these trying times. Today, I'm going to shift gears a little bit, and I'm having a guest in the studio. His name is Dr. Peter Pressman, and Peter is a specialist in the world of frontal temporal degeneration, and I'm excited to introduce him to all of you and talk a lot about this subject, which I get a ton of emails and letters and questions about because it's a very, very difficult disease. So with that, I'd like to introduce you to Dr. Peter Pressman. Okay, Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's always great to have you on for our listeners because I receive a lot of questions about frontal temporal degeneration, and people just don't understand the disease. And I'm hoping that through our conversation today, you can clarify a few questions my listeners have. And also just really give them some great information on understanding the disease a little bit better and its symptoms and so on and so forth. But let's start with your background and why you've chosen to study and work with frontal temporal degeneration.
So I'm a cognitive and behavioral neurologist. I'm now at the University of Colorado. I came here from San Francisco, where their Memory and Aging Center focuses heavily on the frontotemporal dementias. I was particularly interested in the frontotemporal dementias because they are so uniquely challenging and also intriguing. The way that the disease can impact all aspects of communication, both what someone says, how they say it, and also just who they are, their very personality, is kind of central to what makes us human, and that drew me to neurology more broadly.
And you really hit on a big issue, and that is their personality changes. So unlike other diseases where we can see a physical transformation in the person, we see more emotional and psychological changes in people with this disease, right?
That's absolutely correct. So it's really normal for someone with the behavioral variant of frontotemporal dementia to be diagnosed with a primary psychiatric disorder for a while before a diagnosis of a neurodegenerative condition, such as the behavioral variant of frontotemporal dementia, is arrived at.
Mm-hmm.
I will emphasize that all neurodegenerative diseases have the potential of impacting personality, but it's really much more prominent in the behavioral variant. It's one of the first things that changes, and it's one of the most pronounced changes. And they tend to change in certain ways that let us recognize that this is the behavioral variant, as opposed to, say, someone with Alzheimer's disease who is having some personality changes in the setting of that disease.
Okay. Well, before we get into the different types under the frontotemporal, flag, why don't we talk about what causes it? Because that's a big question. Do you know what causes it?
No.
That's a tough one, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a tough one. I don't think anybody really knows what causes these diseases. And unlike, say, Alzheimer's disease, where there are certain markers on the brain, if we were to look at them under a microscope, that being, say, sheets of beta amyloid and tangles of tau, within particularly the behavioral variant of frontotemporal dementia, it's very hard to predict what proteins we will see misfolded if we look at the brain under a microscope.
Mm-hmm.
Broadly speaking, there are three main groups, including problems with tau, including problems with something called TDP43, and another protein called FUS, which is a little less common than the other two. And sometimes Alzheimer's disease can masquerade as frontotemporal dementia as well.
That's true. And that, I think, I saw that in my own brother because he had attention deficits. He would just move from one thing to the next. And we thought that maybe he was just having short-term memory and sort of flittering back and forth in the conversation or just forgetting what we were talking about, when in fact he didn't have any memory issues per se. It was more attention issues.
Right. And that's one of the first things that we try to address in our clinic. Almost everybody who comes in says that they're having a memory problem. But when we sort through things a little bit more, sometimes it has to do with attention or organizational abilities, or they're only losing their memory for certain words, which we would consider to be a language problem.
Mm-hmm.
So we try our best to sort through that, but it takes some time and some expertise to really get to the bottom of.
Right. So let's go through the symptoms of the behavioral variant. What I have seen in the people that I work with in their homes, and again, even with my brother, is that we will see a lack of impulse control. They get laser focused on a subject and just can't get off of it and will continue to ask the same questions about it or do the same activity over and over and over again. That's something I've seen really strongly with my brother. So as an example, he likes to listen to karaoke 5 nights a week.
Mm-hmm.
And he golfs every day.
Yep.
And those are the two activities that he basically does.
Yeah, so you're touching on one of 6 core criteria for what we would consider possible behavioral variant frontotemporal dementia.
Okay.
That being kind of a obsessive or compulsive behavior. Sometimes these can be very simple, like just repeating the same movement over and over, and sometimes they become very ornate. Some people start practicing new, very complicated rituals. Most of the time, though, I think it just is kind of a rigid adherence to something that they would have been doing anyway. So
okay.
An example would be someone who likes sandwiches but also likes other food suddenly only wants to eat sandwiches, and only one type of sandwich, only on one type of one time of day. So we have seen that in behavioral variant. Another thing that people can develop is this hyperorality or dietary changes. where they may start binge eating or putting things in the mouth that aren't even edible. So someone may develop a great love of bananas, and as the disease progresses, get to a point where they also start trying to eat the peel, for example.
Okay. Wow. All right. Can we go through those six pieces of criteria there?
Sure. We've touched on two of them, right, which include these perseverative, stereotyped, or compulsive ritualistic behaviors. That's one. Mm-hmm. Hyperorality and dietary changes are another. Really key one is early loss of sympathy or empathy. People can become less feeling. They can have less interest in social interaction with their loved ones.
That's a big one. It really is. I think that apathy towards other people's feelings, no longer socially engaging and interacting like they used to, those are big issues for families.
Yeah, I think that's one of the hardest ones for many caregivers, because you keep giving and giving and giving to someone who doesn't really appear to be very appreciative.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, it's heartbreaking, and it's disillusioning. Caregivers go through a lot of emotions with this, and they just don't understand why the person with the disease doesn't. It seems like they lose their emotional, intentional actions. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I agree with that. I actually think that the loss of empathy in frontotemporal dementia is very complex as well. I think some people lose their ability to read others' emotions.
Mm-hmm.
Some people may have a retained ability to read emotions, but just don't care about the emotions that they're reading. And I think still other people may read emotions, may care, yet be unable to convey their own empathy appropriately. I think often as the disease progresses, we see some combination of all three factors in empathetic loss.
Right.
You touched on apathy earlier, mm-hmm. and that apathy can extend beyond just social interaction to be more broad. This is another core feature of BFTD, where they just have lost interest in things that they would previously have enjoyed. They may not want to do much of anything. And as the disease progresses, we tend to see more and more of that.
Wow.
This is in contrast to yet another feature with behavioral variant frontotemporal dementia, which is socially inappropriate behavior, impulsivity, loss of manners or decorum. So
mm-hmm.
rather than necessarily just sitting apathetically, these people may be really impulsively doing things that we'd rather they not.
Okay. Can you give a few examples?
Sure. So this touches a little bit on criminal behavior in BVFTD, which is, of course, also stressful, and we do see this occasionally. It tends to result more from just thoughtless behavior or impulsive behavior than anything that requires much planning, because executive dysfunction and the inability to plan is another feature of this mm-hmm. disease. But, for example, they may get arrested for shoplifting because if they were walking down the aisles, they're just snatching candy bars right off the shelf.
Okay.
They may go at a red light because they just don't feel like waiting anymore. Those tend to be the sorts of things that we see. Sometimes we can also see socially inappropriate comments that are offensive to other people. And we may see very poor financial decisions being made if they still have control of the finances at that point.
That's a huge issue right there. I'm glad you've touched on that. Because pulling these two together, I think I've seen multiple cases of families who share with me that their loved one is spending money. They will say they have a budget, but they don't. They don't seem to understand judgment. Their judgment and reasoning is skewed to the point that they don't understand how much money they have to work with. They tend to spend more than they make, more than they're bringing in. And when you try to have that discussion with them, it's like talking to a blank wall. They become offended. They think you're attacking them. And it's one of the bigger issues I deal with when I'm trying to help families navigate through this journey.
Yeah, someone a few years ago published a paper on the social and economic burden of frontotemporal degeneration. That's actually the paper's title, where they demonstrate that the economic burden of FTD is very high. All dementias are high, but especially so in frontotemporal dementia. And in part, that is due to the younger age of onset. Mm-hmm. So the age of onset of frontotemporal dementias can be younger, under the age of 65, for example. Mm-hmm. And so you lose wages, you can accrue more legal fees, you can be more susceptible to be taken advantage of in scams. And all of this really adds up to a financial cost on top of all the unique emotional toll of this disorder.
And this generally affects people between the ages of 44 and 64. Is that true?
It can go that low, certainly. And the average can be somewhere in the 60s, the early 60s. Mm-hmm. It is the most common dementia in people under the age of 60, right there neck and neck with young onset Alzheimer's disease. Mm-hmm. But you can get it in older age as well. So it's not like you're out of the woods after the age of 65. Unfortunately, we've seen cases that can extend up into the 80s and probably further.
Wow. Okay. I think we've hit on four of your six. Let's continue.
Let me just run down the list.
Okay.
I think we've touched on all of them, but the truth is that sometimes they kind of blur together, and it can make it difficult to say, you know, is this apathy or is this loss of empathy or what? So the six altogether would be early behavioral disinhibition, early apathy, early loss of sympathy or empathy, early stereotyped or compulsive behaviors, hyperorality and dietary changes, and executive dysfunction. Mm-hmm. So if you have three of those six things, you would meet a criteria for what we call possible behavioral variant frontotemporal dementia. Mm-hmm. If you have a scan that also shows frontal or temporal atrophy or a PET scan showing less than expected activity in one of those areas, then you meet criteria for probable BVFTD.
Okay.
And if you are one of those people who has a genetic mutation that can cause the disease, in that case, you would meet criteria for definite BVFTD. It's one of the only ways that we can do this in the living.
Okay. So let's go ahead, and since you brought that up, I want to talk to you about that genetic mutation. Now, you and I have had conversations, multiple conversations, over the fact that my mom, posthumously, 4 years after her death, was discovered to have the C9ORF72 gene mutation. I have never understood what the ORF meant, and I don't know what the whole thing means. So I always thought the C9 was what caused Lou Gehrig's disease. And that may or may not be, but we can go into that later. And then the C9ORF was causing frontal temporal, and then my mom had to throw in the 72. So how do you decipher all that, Dr. Pressman?
not quite. So the entire thing is actually called C9ORF, that's open reading frame, 72 mutation. Sometimes, because that's a mouthful, we will just abbreviate it to C9ORF, or we'll just say C9 if we're extra in a hurry.
Oh, okay.
But they're all the same class of mutations. This is what we call an expansion repeat. So there is a repeat of six nucleotides in the chromosome. And if you expand that repeat beyond a certain number, then we start seeing certain symptoms arise. Now, sometimes C9ORF72 can cause amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, what you just called Lou Gehrig's disease.
Okay.
Sometimes it can cause frontotemporal dementia, as we've been discussing. So why it does one or the other is another one of those things that I can't really tell you. I just don't think we know. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, it's unclear why some people with C9ORF72 mutations don't rapidly worsen, but rather kind of simmer for a long period of time, we have had some cases where somebody with this mutation just is not exactly socially normal. But it's unclear if they just have a psychiatric illness or if they're actually getting worse or not. And then you get the gene test, and lo and behold, there it is, and you can predict how things are going to go. Mm-hmm. C9ORF72 mutations are also a little funny based off those diagnostic criteria that I just discussed, because sometimes the imaging changes are not at all obvious. Oh. You do not necessarily see very clear volume loss in the frontal or temporal lobes in a C9ORF72 mutation. So those diagnostic criteria were published just before we were really beginning to understand and learn more about this mutation. And I think if we had more information about C9ORF72 when those criteria were established, they might read a little differently.
You know, and speaking of reading a little differently, my mom presented as though she had classic Alzheimer's, and yet she had this gene mutation. And she really did not have any of the behavioral variant symptoms. She was as sweet as a kitten. She really was. And lasted for 23 years. And my brother has had more of the behavioral variant, where my sister, who is newly diagnosed, is following in my mom's footsteps a little bit more. And so I just find this fascinating. And that number that you said, where at that point you're looking at, maybe you didn't say it this way, but you have more of a focus on the full-blown pathology of the disease. Her doctor told her it was the number 60, and she is way past that. She's in the 400s. So does that mean something to you?
I don't think anybody has ever done a good job correlating the number of repeats with symptom severity or symptom type.
Okay.
There's still a great deal that we don't understand about C9ORF72 because it is the most recently described of the three major genes that can cause frontotemporal dementia.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of situation that you just mentioned, where someone can actually just seem to have cognitive problems, has also been described. And so it's not something that we can really correlate or connect the gene mutation with what we are going to see in the patient very well. We don't have that pathological correlation very well yet.
As a doctor, is that frustrating to you? It's frustrating to me seeing it in my family, because I can see my sister has a higher number on the genetic testing than my brother has, and he was diagnosed 10 years ago.
As a doctor, it's really difficult to just say, oh, it couldn't be C9ORF72 if there's any sort of family history of neurodegenerative disease.
Mm-hmm.
Because it can cause so many different types of symptoms, I have ordered it under a wide array of different conditions. So someone could be coming in with mostly a movement disorder, and I may want to order it. Someone may be coming in primarily with thinking problems, and I may want to order it. However, I will not usually order it unless there is a strong family history suggestive of a genetic mutation.
Right. Well, as a physician in this area, it just really blows my mind how fascinating this must be to you. It's fascinating to me, because when I meet families out in the community that are asking, how do I live with this? How do I control my emotions? How do I work with them having a lack of emotion and things like that? I just can't even imagine how difficult it is for you just trying to discern which direction this is going per person. That's
right.
Wow.
Well, fortunately, genetic mutations only cause between 15% to 35% of all cases of frontotemporal dementia, at least that we're aware of.
Wow.
So the majority of cases do not seem to be correlated with one of the genetic variants that we can test for presently.
Mm-hmm.
The other two are also kind of heterogeneous in the way that they can present. But I think one of them, particularly the progranulin mutation, is easier to predict. If I see a scan of a brain where one hemisphere is predominantly smaller than the other, then that really suggests a progranulin mutation to me if there's also a family history.
Okay, and what would that What would that do?
If one hemisphere is smaller than the other, it can cause symptoms that are associated with that hemisphere. So if the left hemisphere, for example, atrophies faster than the right, we may see more language problems. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I have seen some cases where that is the initial problem. It's coming up with words, as you can see in the other two variants of frontotemporal dementias, which are both primary progressive aphasias. Mm-hmm. As the disease progresses over time, however, we do usually see some personality changes come on as well.
Okay. I had a client recently who had the primary progressive aphasia diagnosis, and that person would repeat familiar phrases over and over again. Numbers, 2, 3, 4, 5, boom. 5, 6, 7, 8, boom. Or repeat what you say, echophasia, just like your worst little 5-year-old brother repeating everything you say. Is that one of the primary symptoms at times?
I wouldn't say that necessarily a sign of primary progressive aphasia most of the time.
Oh, okay.
There are various types of primary progressive aphasia, and they're all associated with word-finding problems. But when I see that sort of echolalia or palalalia, mm-hmm. repeating what other people say or repeating what you say, mm-hmm. that also can be a feature of the behavioral variant, where you have a kind of obsessive, repeated behavior. Now, all of these diseases do blend together. Mm-hmm. And so someone who starts having just a primary progressive aphasia, especially, for example, if it's a semantic variant, will usually develop some behavioral problems as the disease goes on as well. And as behavioral variant goes on over time, we sometimes see some language changes in that. Okay. That's something that I'm particularly interested in and am looking at myself in my own research.
Okay. And is that something that is more common, the primary progressive aphasia, or as common as the behavioral variant, or it's just kind of running a close second behind?
I'd actually say they're pretty equal, close enough that I couldn't quite say which was more common. There are two subtypes of primary progressive aphasia that are considered frontotemporal dementia, the okay. semantic variant of primary progressive aphasia, or PPA, and the non-fluent variant of primary progressive aphasia, or PPA. Mm-hmm. Each of those, I'd say, take up about 25% of all cases of FTD, which then adds up to about 50% being PPA and the remaining 50% being the behavioral variant.
Okay. Okay. And what about the people that have this disease maybe losing their balance and their motor skills? Is that something that happens?
Oh, yes. So the frontotemporal dementias overlap with a lot of movement disorders and neuromuscular disorders. Mm-hmm. So somewhere around 15% of all frontotemporal dementias will develop amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS or Lou Gehrig's. Mm-hmm. And somewhere around 50% of patients with ALS have some personality or behavioral changes that accompany that. In addition, there are other movement disorders like progressive supranuclear palsy or corticobasal syndrome, which can also overlap with features of frontotemporal dementias. Mm-hmm. So we keep a very close eye on all of our patients with frontotemporal dementia to see if they're going to develop movement problems, because we want to prevent things like falls or difficulty swallowing.
Right. And one symptom I see often is, with my brother especially, is when he sits down, he just falls asleep. He's had situations where he gets a little off balance, and when that happens, he sits down and he just falls asleep. Is that just because he's sleepy, or is that something having to do with the disease?
The disease can make people sleepy. Sleep disruption is common in most neurodegenerative conditions, and frontotemporal dementia is no exception. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, as the apathy continues to progress and grow throughout the disease course, It's easier for some people just to kind of shut off and revert back to sleep.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Sometimes, yeah.
Go ahead.
Sometimes, really, that can be a blessing for caregivers, especially if they've really been struggling with early impulsivity or really problematic behaviors. It's kind of nice when the patient who has been doing all of these things instead would just rather sit on the couch and nap or watch television.
Well, all I have to say is yay for that, because the caregivers are absolutely worn out. We're going to take a short break, and we will be right back.
Living and working with Alzheimer's and other dementias can often be challenging. Summit Resilience Training provides education utilizing non-medical approaches for those who work with our friends affected by dementia. Believing families still need one-on-one assistance, we provide classes which help them understand the diseases affecting their loved ones, offering strategies and techniques for success with activities of daily living and working with confusing behaviors. We offer in-home assessments to clarify symptoms of dementia diseases and help families work together to find moments of joy while living with memory loss and impairment. Education programs instilling person-centered care philosophies are offered for professional caregivers working in communities and homes, which can be customized for their staff. Training is also available for first responders, such as law enforcement, fire, and EMT personnel. We are passionate that people with dementias, such as Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and others, are approached with compassion and understanding, and those who work with them have all the tools they need for success. Call us at Summit Resilience Training, 303-420-6988, to schedule a class or in-home assessment. Visit our website at summitresiliencetraining.com for more information.
Welcome back to Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz.
All right, we're back. And I have Dr. Peter Pressman with me. And Peter is a neurologist at the University of Colorado Anschutz location. I should have said that better, Peter. But you work with people with frontal temporal and with Alzheimer's. But today we're tackling the questions and the really crazy scenario of the symptoms that happen with people with frontal temporal degeneration. And you've explained very well in the first segment here why we see some of the symptoms that we see and some of the characteristics that define the diseases under the dementia flag of frontotemporal. But I want to get a little bit deeper into it and talking about, we see a lot of folks that you just cannot reason with them. You can't carry on a conversation. You can't explain why they shouldn't spend money. That is one of the biggest nightmares I think caregivers have. Your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. You cannot reason with a brain that has been injured. The way that we are used to talking to our loved ones who are going through this may no longer work as the disease progresses over time. One of the reasons for this is a fancy term that we call anosognosia, which just means you don't know what you don't know. Because we know everything through the brain. If the brain is injured, it frequently will not recognize the extent to which it can no longer do things. There are other reasons why it's difficult to communicate with people with frontotemporal dementia. They may, in fact, have language deficits, as we've been discussing, and their communication deficits may also extend to more paralinguistic aspects of communication. So, for example, they may fail to recognize sarcasm or the tone of voice that indicates distress or frustration. So there's many opportunities for communication breakdown. And so what we tend to recommend then is just relying on techniques such as changing the subject, redirecting, and not arguing a point, because often there's no winning that argument.
Right. And one of the techniques I give to families is try to deal, even though, you know, we just said that there's a lot of apathy and lack of empathy, but trying to talk through the emotion of a situation rather than the issue. Say you're trying to take car keys away because they've been driving erratically and not paying attention to the rules of the road, and they are a danger to themselves and others. And driving is a big, big issue. But if you try to tell a person with frontal temporal that they should no longer drive, they might say, I drive better than you. Don't tell me what to do. You know?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So other strategies are often called for.
Right. And at that point, I always tell families, listen, talk about how much driving has meant to a person, their independence. And if they feel like they're going to lose that independence, how could you bring in some alternatives to try to fill in the void? Maybe being able to take someone, that person, to a doctor's appointment or something and have lunch afterwards. Or, you know, just say, well, how about if I drive with you for a while and let's see how this goes. And if I'm not scared, that won't be a problem. And then if it is a problem, then you could suggest, why don't we just go over to a company that can evaluate your driving skills so we can have a scientific evaluation of your driving, as opposed to me telling you can't drive. I mean, there's just a lot of ways we have to beat around this bush because it's such big issues like this.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Particularly with driving, it varies state by state regarding the law. And so here in Colorado, I will frequently say that I will recommend a driving evaluation because while, unlike other states, I'm not required to report to the DMV, there could still be legal consequences for someone who chooses to drive after being told that they are impaired. And so I recommend, if nothing else, getting tested as a way to protect themselves legally from those potential consequences.
Well, that's right. And on a little bit of a different subject, when I think one of the biggest confusing points arise when a family member is trying to talk to someone with this disease, especially the behavioral variant, and they're trying to explain to them that they see these issues and that the person themselves may not see it. And the person with the diagnosis gets angry. And families feel like they have to step in on a financial basis or something like that because that person is spending too much money or is not paying their bills. But because the person looks as though they have no physical ailment, it's very difficult to invoke power of attorney or even get that person in for a diagnosis.
I agree. And, you know, one of the problems with especially the behavioral variant of frontotemporal dementia is that their primary problems are behavioral. Often people will score very well still on standardized tests. So if you were to do a standardized test called the mini mental state exam, for example, they may do great. And it's hard to then say, well, no, you're really struggling because despite scoring so high on this, you may choose to run a red light or drive the wrong way down the street just because. So it's one of the reasons why I encourage everybody to set up a power of attorney sooner rather than later, to have these discussions with your loved one to make it easier to invoke when you need it. It can be very hard to invoke or draft a power of attorney when somebody is impaired.
Well, that is true. And even if you can get that done ahead of time when the person isn't really aware or not showing significant apathy or lack of empathy and get that put in place, but boy, once you actually see the issues coming forth, it's hard to get that person into the doctor so that you can say, please let me take over their financials because they're running out of money. They won't go to the doctor. So in some ways,
that can be a real challenge.
Yes, it's really hard. Have you had people call you to make an appointment for their loved one and say, I just can't get them in to see you?
Yes. I have had that. It also may play a role in why people with behavioral variant frontotemporal dementia are diagnosed late, usually, in the disease course. It may also be that we have to get to a point where that apathy kind of kicks in. And they're just like, yeah, fine, I'll go with you wherever. But everybody with behavioral variant frontotemporal dementia presents a little bit differently. And so you can't necessarily count on that.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I'm interested in developing are more tools that can help primary care doctors recognize early signs of the disease and even help family members recognize this in a way that doesn't demand a very lengthy neurological evaluation, which some people with BVFTD just don't have patience for.
Right. And you know, one thing, I'll give you one little clue I've been working on. Maybe this will help you. I don't know. But I tell families when they're struggling in this realm, try to maintain the ego of the person, if that makes any sense to you. Maintain the ego of the person, the things that they have always done well, the way that they used to be very in tune to others' feelings, and give them a lot of kudos and talk to them about the things that maybe you've learned from them. So that way you're not trying to reason with them. You're just sort of stroking their ego a little bit, and then it's easier to have a conversation. Once I started using that technique, it was easier for me to talk to the person with the disease when they're in someone's home.
Yeah, I think that's a good thing, certainly, to try. I also would recommend to any loved one of somebody who has BVFTD to meet other people who have gone through this, to try to figure out what worked for them, because it's certainly not one size fits all. You may have to try a few things before you figure out what works for your family.
Well, that's right. I was at the Lewy Body Convention in December, by the way, and you were a speaker there. And I think I might have been rude because I took pictures of a few of your slides. I've heard that that's
That's
not good etiquette, but I don't care. I want your information.
Understood.
But anyway, you had a slide that was talking about medications that don't per se work well, that can complicate the situation with people with FTD.
Yeah, we think so. So there's certainly no reason to believe that the medications that work for Alzheimer's disease, such as the acetylcholinesterase inhibitors like Aricept, also called donepezil, help in frontotemporal dementia. They just don't have the same deficit in that neurotransmitter that patients with Alzheimer's disease do.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, we tend to focus on a different neurotransmitter, that is serotonin. Sometimes by boosting levels of serotonin, we may see some improvement in behaviors. If instead we just try to treat everything the same and treat frontotemporal dementia like we would Alzheimer's, there have been cases where we think that the donepezil makes symptoms worse. Mm. And sometimes we see an improvement in symptoms than when we remove that medication.
Okay.
That's one of the reasons why it's important to make a good diagnosis and know what you're treating.
And how about allergy medicines? As I recall, you had a list of medications that people really should not take if they're trying to maintain retention and things that could complicate retention. And one of them was allergy meds, as I recall.
Well, one of them was Benadryl,
right,
which is diphenhydramine. Sometimes also has an anticholinergic effect.
Oh.
So certainly we would recommend against those things in Alzheimer's disease or in dementia with Lewy bodies, in which there's a very clear cholinergic deficit. The effect of those medications on patients with frontotemporal dementias is less clear. There's reasons to think that they might make you a little bit fuzzy-headed, like Benadryl can before it helps you go to sleep at night. But I wouldn't expect it to have as profound an effect as it can on cognition in Alzheimer's or dementia with Lewy bodies.
Okay. Well, that's good to know, because if we're taking anything that's making it worse, we want to know that. And there really,
absolutely.
And there really are very few, if any, drugs that can assist. There's no cure for this disease.
That's true. There is no cure for the frontotemporal dementias. That doesn't mean that there's no help to be found.
Agreed.
I think that there are some medications which may be helpful, but at least as important, and probably more important, our recommendations and guidelines on planning for the future and managing behaviors.
That is so true. And, you know, people ask me a lot, why is it important to know about these different diseases if there's no cure for them? And I think you've just said it very well. There's ways that we can plan. Go ahead.
No, I absolutely agree. I feel particularly strongly about this in the frontotemporal dementias, for example. But I think the ability to plan for that individual's future, the ability to better manage their behavior. And in the case of frontotemporal dementias, we may also need to have a conversation about genetics and about what this may mean for other family members.
Can we talk about that for a minute? What does that mean
Sure.
if multiple people in your family have it?
So if there's a strong family history of frontotemporal dementia, you may or you may not want to have that individual tested. It's a complex and very personal question. The benefits of getting tested are that then there is an answer. Mm-hmm. As I said earlier, this is one of the few ways that we could say, okay, this is definitely behavioral variant frontotemporal dementia, and now we know that there is a genetic risk. By virtue of having a gene, any child of that person would have about a 50% chance of having the disease his or herself. Now, that may not be something that they want to know.
Right.
Some of us are planners. We would want to know. We would definitely be tested. We would want to participate in clinical trials, for example, which are sometimes looking for people who have a gene but are not yet affected symptomatically.
Mm-hmm.
Other people definitely don't want to know. They feel like then their fate is written, and they'll just look forward to that dreaded day where they begin showing those symptoms. Furthermore, there can be certain consequences of having a genetic mutation. While you are protected for health insurance mm-hmm. By the laws that protect pre-existing conditions, those same protections are not necessarily in place for long-term care or life insurance.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another thing that may need to be weighed before choosing whether or not you're going to go down the route of genetic testing.
Right.
I'll frequently recommend that people talk with a genetic counselor before they get the test if they're really considering it, although unfortunately such counselors can be in short supply.
Right. That is true. I'm wondering if you would mind answering a couple of listeners' questions. See what you
sure.
think. Okay. One of them was, could you maybe mention in the segment how to approach your loved one with the changes you've noticed and possible FTDs, ways to positively share your concerns without feeling like it's a personal attack or pointing fingers at all the wrong things they're doing?
Boy, that's a question that really depends on each individual person and the relationship that you have.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, you can just phrase things broadly, like, you know, I hear that as people get older, more and more people are just having cognition checked as part of their general medical examination. That is true, by the way, and should be done more often. You may also just be able to say, you know, I've noticed a couple things. I don't know if I should be concerned or not, but I'd sure feel better if we could get that checked out. Do you mind if we go and visit this doctor? And in some cases, really, where I have seen just dense anosognosia, meaning this person cannot perceive it. There's no way that they're going to understand why they're in that doctor's office. Then you just bring them.
Right.
I can't tell you how often I see a patient and I ask, so what brings you here today? And they just point at their family member.
Right.
That's all they know.
Right. One of the other questions was, how do we prepare for the worst case scenario and the hard truth of how damaging it can be for a relationship? The truth of the matter is there's no crystal ball. There is no crystal ball. And you and I both know that this can be one of the hardest diseases to work with. It's just...
Absolutely.
It's emotionally draining.
Yes, but I would emphasize that people actively seek help and that they do so early on. And that they are very aggressive in their own self-care.
I agree with that. Right.
Because this can be so draining for caregivers, unless they are really making sure that they're taking time to do the things that they find restful and replenishing, they're at a real risk of burning out. And if they get sick, then it doesn't help anybody. It all falls down.
That is so true. And, you know, we're very fortunate to be in a large city where we have a lot of resources at our fingertips. I don't know if you know this, but I have listeners in all 50 states and 44 countries, and many of them are in remote corners where there isn't a support group they can go to. There isn't any information. So there is an online access to FTD.org, I believe it is.
AFTD, Association for Frontotemporal Dementias.
Thank you. There you go, AFTD.org. And that could help them at the very least. There are books. And in this online world, we really can find a lot of information at our fingertips. How would they find reliable sources? Do you think that one is one of the best?
I do. For frontotemporal dementias, I think AFTD.org is a really good site. Sometimes, especially in rural areas, though, internet access can be limited as well.
That's true.
And then we may need to really rely increasingly on friends and family members, really asking them to step up. That's one of the benefits of close-knit communities is often people just jump in and help each other out. If you cannot find that sort of support, though, this is an awfully hard thing to try to go through on your own. And so I would consider all options to find a way to get support, even if that would include moving to a place that would have more resources.
And attending conferences. There are more and more conferences across the country that families could go to, correct?
That is generally true. The Association for Frontotemporal Dementias, for example, does offer up those conferences. We have offered those here at the University of Colorado. I had to emphasize the generally right now because the Association for Frontotemporal Dementias just had to cancel their caregiver conference in the wake of the COVID-19 crisis.
Right. True. And by the way, you sent me something on email today that I had not had a chance to look at, but you said was interesting information. Would you share what that information was?
Yeah, I only received this in my email today from the Association for Frontotemporal Dementias, which just touches on some of the unique risks among people with frontotemporal dementia for COVID-19. So, for example, one of the genetic mutations, the GRN or granulin mutation, that can cause frontotemporal dementia, that mutation impacts the immune system. And so, at least in theory, there may be increased susceptibility to that viral infection.
Wow.
And then there are other things that are just kind of the basics of trying to keep yourself healthy, even generally, but especially in a pandemic. People with behavioral variant frontotemporal dementias may be less likely to pay attention to their own hygiene. They may not want to wash or bathe, or they may also lack that social insight and may be more impulsive. So it may be a real challenge to try to keep them away from other people or touching those people. So doing all of those basic things we've all been told, washing your hands, try to keep your distance, don't cough or sneeze into other people's faces.
Right.
All of this may be really compromised in FTD. And then when you add in the fact that some of these people will live in communities of older individuals, you may be setting yourself up for kind of a recipe for disaster unless you're really paying close attention to those behaviors and trying to adjust them as well as possible under the circumstances.
Wow, you've hit on some things that I can just see people cringing in there as they're listening to this podcast and saying, "Oh my gosh, how am I gonna keep my loved one from going and getting their nails done three times this week? That's what they do, you know, or wanting to, you know, we do realize that one of the symptoms, I think, is that sometimes people are sexually heightened. And like you said, they like to hug people or want to dance with people and things like that. And that could be rough.
Yeah. And for all the reasons we've covered, trying to just explain to them that they can't do this now may not work.
Right.
So There may be unique challenges here. Sometimes it's helpful to try to work with the symptoms of frontotemporal dementia, though. So, for example, if somebody is especially distractible, giving them a cell phone that you can just call when they're about to do something they shouldn't. If somebody is particularly impulsive and really likes watching television, well, if you want them to stay home, maybe now is a good time to encourage that particular compulsion.
I love it. We're going to make these diseases work for us, right?
The idea is kind of a medical judo.
Do you know the statistics? How many people have this disease in the United States or worldwide? Do you know?
It's not as common as many other types of dementia, but I wouldn't say that it's exactly rare either. Some people estimate between 50 to 60,000 Americans likely have this. And that might be somewhere around 22 per 100,000 people. Some of those statistics are a little dated, though, and may underrepresent the true prevalence. As we are getting better recognizing this disease and distinguishing it from other sorts of problems, such as not only Alzheimer's, but primary psychiatric disorders, I think we might see that it's actually more common than we realized.
Wow. Well, I cannot thank you enough in this busy time and with everything shutting down and Americans trying to do their part to make sure that this coronavirus doesn't extend to more and more people. I know you're as busy as you've ever been, and yet we have less public gatherings that we can have. So I thank you for your time today and explaining all this to my listeners.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, you have a wonderful day, Dr. Pressman. And for all my listeners, in the upcoming weeks, I have my Alzheimer's classes through the University of Colorado Neurology Department. And those classes are now going to go online. Instead of meeting in person and teaching people, I know that's more effective generally and people feeling they're understood and being able to talk about the things they want to, but I am moving these online. So you will be able to join in a Zoom video conference if you would like to from anywhere in the world. You can find that information on my website at summitresiliencetraining.com or call me at 303-420-6988. Thank you all for listening. Stay safe in your homes. Please do your part and check on your seniors and friends in your area that may need your assistance. Until next week with Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz.
You've been listening to Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz. To learn more about her resources, services, classes, or to book speaking engagements, visit Jill's website at summitresiliencetraining.com. A new podcast drops every Tuesday, so join us as we learn more about dementias, resilience, and overcoming obstacles to find a positive outcome. Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz can be found on your favorite podcast provider. Please subscribe and give us a 5-star rating. Musical and technical support provided by Brian Hunter. See you next week.